My name is Ed Goldberg, and as soon as I get my chair set here, I will sit down and introduce an author, Ian Lee. Ian, welcome to Portland.
Thank you very much.
I notice you're using the Western, your family name second, rather than Lee Eun.
Yes.
Did you do that when you came to this country?
Yes, only because, you know, it's confusing if I put my last name first.
Yes, and when your publicist got a hold of me, I said, oh, so her name is Lee? I said, no, it's...
That's right.
The title of the book is The Vagrants, and it's published by Random House. And this is a story of 1979 China in the aftermath and still in the throes, really, of the Great Cultural Revolution, although Mao is already dead by a couple of years. But the first question I have is, and I normally don't ask this because it becomes obvious from reading it, why did you title this The Vagrants?
It's very interesting. I'm sorry, I'm blabbering.
That's all right.
The characters, in a way, were all locked in this place. In a way, in 1979, for a long time, most Chinese people did not have the freedom to wander around the land. So they had to stay where they, you know, had the legal rights. However, I had a couple of characters in this novel who made a living by garbage collecting, and so they did not have legal rights to live anywhere. And I was very fascinated by this couple story because I read it in the news somewhere in China. There was this older couple who...
This would be the Hua in your book.
Hua, Mrs. Hua and Mr. Hua, yeah. And in the real news, they were garbage collectors, and they brought up 37 baby girls who were deserted. And it was very hard.
37.
Yeah. And it was heartbreaking because when the girls turned 6 and 7, the government would come in and say you did not have the right to bring up these baby girls because they did not have birth certificates or, you know, city residence. So the girls would be taken away from them for orphanages. But still, the couple just did not lose hope. And, they, you know, over 40 years, they brought up 37 girls. And I really loved that story. And I thought I would use that couple as an anchor for the novel. So you see, when their story comes into the novel, their story threads through the novel about their 7 girls. And so in the end, I think I named the book after these 2 characters. But also, you know, they did have the freedom to wander. But in the end, I think the other characters were all sorts of vagrants because, you know, they did not settle down in their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a novel, but it's about China at a very desperate time in its existence, modern China. And I'm constantly tempted, I'm going to do it now, to run off onto tangents. Because since I know several people who have adopted Chinese baby girls, the idea of abandoning a female child in China was, I don't know if it was frowned upon officially, but it was done widely. And the reason I think that most children adopted from China are girls is that nobody wants them. Is that true?
I don't know how true it is now. It is probably still true because you probably will find more girls in orphanage than boys. But when we grew up, I mean, around the time when the novel took place, it was rather, I guess, widely done in smaller cities or in rural area, I think, in a way. People did want boys more than they wanted girls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there's still the official one-child policy in China?
I think the policy has relaxed a little, but officially I think one-child policy is still in place.
Mm-hmm. You know, your book has a lot of characters, and I had to write a bunch of them down. I know I didn't get everybody, but let's start with, as the book does, with Teacher Gu and Mrs. Gu. Teacher Gu is a teacher. He has been teaching in this town for a long time, although he's retired now, I believe.
He just retired after the execution of his daughter.
And that's what's happening. On the very first day of the book, we have Gu Shan, the daughter, being executed as a counter-revolutionary. How did she wind up in that predicament?
It was a very bizarre story. Again, I learned a little bit from history, but she had one time been a frantic Red Guard, and somehow, you know, she was tired of being a loyal follower of Cultural Revolution, so she renounced her faith in Cultural Revolution, in communism, and she wrote a lot about her doubts in a letter to her boyfriend. And her boyfriend turned her letters into the government, and she was imprisoned for 10 years. And While she was in prison, she kept writing and kept a journal. She kept a journal and she kept writing letters and arguing for herself. And that got her a retrial. And she was retried as a counter-revolutionary and she was sentenced to death after that trial.
The great proletarian culture revolution in China. China's had a long, long history, better than 5,000 years as a culture. Mm-hmm. They've been through a lot of ups and downs. Is it fair to say that one of the worst things that ever happened to China was the great proletarian culture revolution?
I would say in modern history.
In modern history, yeah.
Yeah, if you look
back. I guess Genghis Khan was pretty bad also, yeah.
Right,
but, yeah.
Right.
But this, the excesses of the Cultural Revolution and the Red Guards were worldwide stories and horror stories mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And this, although I guess some of the fire has gone out of the Cultural Revolution by this point in 1979, everybody's living with the aftermath of it.
Right. So 1979 was a very interesting year in China. That was when China started to develop economy and technology and started to open its gate to the West.
Was Deng Xiaoping?
Yes, yeah. Deng Xiaoping just came into power and it just started, you know, the reform. And so it was by the time, you know, 1979, people very much wanted to leave the history behind and started a new life. But history came back, you know, haunting you in this or that way. So you could see in the novel that history actually did come back to haunt these people.
The to me, anyway, the heart of this book was Nini and Bashi. And I suppose you planned it that way cleverly, yes. You're smiling and nodding your head. Because the characters in this book are very compelling. The relationship between Bashi and Nini is the part that compelled me the most, the thing that kept me going through the book, wondering how this thing was going to end. And I don't want to get too overly philosophical here, but it occurs to me that Bashi, at 19 years old, a very screwed up kid, is in some way a metaphor for the entire experience of the Cultural Revolution, just wrapped up in one body.
That's very interesting. I did not think of it that way. But although I agree, he was screwed up.
Oh, yeah.
And he also, he was troublesome in a way that I think he represented both the very good and the very bad things in human beings. Maybe that was also what Cultural Revolution
great
did.
Intentions, but terrible in the way everything
yes.
was executed. So.
Yes, and that was probably what, you know, Cultural Revolution did to human beings. They brought up both the very good and very bad things within human nature. So I liked him as a character. No, I don't like
as
him
a person,
as a
not very
person.
Nice.
It was
yeah.
horrible. Right.
Well, let's start with Nini though, because Nini, I loved Nini.
Oh, thank you.
She's a 12-year-old girl. She's had a victim of birth defects. She's physically, she has her hands and her face, one leg, are deformed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm almost hesitant to use that word anymore. It sounds so politically incorrect to say that, but. And she, as the oldest child in her family, you would think that she would have some authority or, you know, some status. But because she's deformed, she's everybody's whipping girl in her family. And she gets no respect anywhere except in one place with the Huas. Tell us about her relationship with the Huas.
It's, you know, the Huas were the garbage collectors who would collect baby girls. And by then, by the time they met Nini, they lost all their daughters. They had lost their daughters, you know, to the government, to the orphanage, and to early marriages. And I think they recognized right away she was an unwanted girl. And they were, you know, they were affectionate with her. And they really wanted to be with her in a way, just to be tender with her, which she did not understand. And she took it for granted. You know, she got food from them. She was fine with that. But she did not understand. And when she did understand, that was, to me, that was the hope of the novel. She got freedom from the Huas, and she was going to be one of the vagrants, you know, with Huas, and she was going to be their daughter in the end, you know, see to their end. So they had a relationship in the end, yeah.
You tell us in the book, though, that Nini, any act of kindness or any act of cruelty was random to her. It was just there. It happened or it didn't happen. She had no way of knowing whether somebody would be cruel or kind to her. So she just accepted that her lot in life was not to know what was going to happen from minute to minute.
Right. And she would not analyze anything. She, you know, she was the kind of the person who would just live in a bad weather, and she would not question, you know, why is it raining today or why is it stormy. She would just say, you know, I'm getting wet, but yeah, so well, I'm going to just stay
everybody
wet.
Gets wet. Yes. Yeah. The rain falls on everyone.
Yeah.
Bashi is a red seed. He's the son of a hero, a Chinese hero who died in the Korean War, I believe.
No, he did not die in the war. He died of tonsillectomy.
Oh, that's right. After being a hero in the war. That's right. I forgot that.
Right,
The funny detail. It's a kind of it's wry and a bit cynical. I found a lot of that in the book. That you have a certain amount of cynicism about the Cultural Revolution and about its effects. Is that true?
Well, your life is, you know, like that.
So he's living on a pension with his grandmother. I don't know. I forget what's happened. Oh, his mother married and moved off to another city, right?
She just, you know, left him.
Right. With good reason, I think, probably. His grandmother is a sweet old lady, but she's very old and she doesn't get out much. And she can barely do for herself.
Right.
And he's 19 years old, and he has, at the beginning of the book, one burning desire, and that's to see a naked girl.
Yes.
What's wrong with Bashi?
You know, it's very interesting. What's wrong? Nothing wrong. He's just curious. The thing I look at it, you know, he's not right to have that. You know, I would say it's very odd he has that desire, but also it's very understandable.
Oh, yes. It's normal for a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old.
Exactly. And I observed my children, 7 and 4, and they have all these, you know, human body encyclopedia, and they will look at human bodies, you know, in a very inquisitive way. But for Bashi, he grew up in this time that no knowledge was accessible to him. And of course, he was curious about women and girls. But he also, with good intention, and he wanted to love a girl. And he wanted to love a girl and in a way that he wanted to understand how a girl was made differently than himself. So that's how he started.
Let me remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Yun Lee, and her first name is spelled Y-I-Y-U-N, last name L-I. Title of the book is The Vagrants, and it's published by Random House. But Bashi's curiosity is morbid. One of the ways he's satisfied is to try to find these abandoned baby girls and look at them and try to get some idea of what an older girl or an older woman would be like.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, he fixates on Nini.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
He had this long scheme of, you know, either, you know, in like seducing a little girl with candy or going to, you know, a woman's bathroom to like look at
spy
a girl, spy
them.
On it.
Yeah.
But of course, he did not carry out any plan. But then, bam, Nini came into his life, and he realized, despite, you know, nobody loved Nini because everybody thought Nini did not look pretty. And all of a sudden, it dawned on him that Nini was a girl, and he could, you know, use that information a little. So he started with this not a very honorable intention of, you know, maybe just to get to know Nini a little. And he made friends with Nini, and he fed her. You know, he brought all these presents to her. But somehow Nini became a real girl when she was, you know, with him, in the way that she became a real self. She became much freer to express her feelings, you know.
She never had anything to think about before she met him.
Right, right. And he was intimidated by this, all of a sudden, by this real girl. And somehow he fell in love with her. And it was a very bizarre love story to me, but it's a love story.
It is. And the thing I keep thinking about Bashi is that every time he does something nice, it's not always from the best of intentions. He's a person of mixed motivations always.
Right, right. And every time he wanted to do something like bad, every time he wanted to do something good, he actually also did something horrible. I think, you know, he wanted to solve this mystery of this man who would, you know, this town's sadistic janitor, but he wanted to take care of the dog, the bad dog, but then he took care of the good dog, you know, in a way.
Oh, we haven't talked about Tang yet. We'll talk about Tang in a little bit. The opening, the first time we meet Nini in the book, it's heartbreaking because old Mrs. Hua, who the trash collector, the street sweeper, has been given a job to put up the posters announcing the denunciation and execution of Gushan. Mm-hmm. And she's putting the posters up on the wall with flour paste. Mm-hmm. And Nini is so hungry that she begs old Mrs. Hua for up the flour paste to eat pieces of it. And finally, the old woman feels so bad for her. She rolls up one of the posters into a cone, pours some paste into it, and says, make sure you throw away the poster because you don't want to be seen using this as a cup.
Uh-huh.
That's so sad. I mean, did this come strictly out of your imagination? Or?
Well, not strictly out of my imagination. It's very interesting. I read that part in a book fair in Edinburgh, and an older woman came afterwards and said, well, you don't look like someone who knew hunger. How did you write that? And I thought, well, you don't know if I know hunger or not. So when someone is hungry, anything edible is, you know, is desired. Mm-hmm. And that I know, you know, from experience. So it made sense to me when she was so hungry and she would scrape the paste off the poster.
Well, you don't have to be a chicken to know what an egg is either.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's talk about Tong. Tong is a country boy.
Yes.
They live in a town called Muddy River. Mm-hmm. Muddy River is an overgrown village. It's grown because people were sent there to work. Mm-hmm. There's a cement factory there or something.
There are a lot of factories.
So this is it's a made up town. It's a mm-hmm. town that was built pretty much from the ground up just to house the workers. And he came in from the country and he feels like a fish out of water. The kids in school make fun of him. They call him garlic breath and things like that. And so he's a loner and he's a good kid. He just can't get any traction with the people there. Mm-hmm. And his only friend is a dog named Ear, E-A-R. I'm sitting here thinking, dog ear? Is this a pun or something? From a book person?
You know? Wow. I did not think about that.
So why Ear? I mean, everybody who knows him and the dog thinks this is a really silly name for a dog. Even in China, it's a really silly name for a dog.
It was a silly name, but again, he was a kid that, you know, he grew up rather freely in the countryside, and nobody had taught any rules about, you know, the world to him. And he was a very good-natured kid, so he learned a few things about the world. He wanted to be a good child. So I think Ear was just one of those things that it made sense to him. It didn't make sense to the world, which was very sad. And it was harmless. It was just a harmless name, but he was laughed at because he named his dog Ear.
Mm-hmm. Well, if he lived in Portland, nobody would bat an eye at a name like that for a dog or a cat. So much goes on in this book that if I try to talk about every little thing in the book, we're not going to get through it. Mm-hmm. Plus, there's a whole lot I don't want to give away. But I do need to talk about Kai and Han.
Yes.
Because Kai and Han, to me, Han is, you know the term Red Prince?
Oh, no, I did not know that, the Red Prince.
A Red Prince is somebody Red Princess is also whose parents have done very well as party members. And they usually live in places like Shanghai, you know, where there's a lot of money in the economy.
Right.
And they go to the best schools, and they go to Europe to buy clothing and all this kind of stuff.
Okay.
He's, in a small way, a Red Prince. Han is Kai's husband. Tell us about the two of them.
So Han, yes, as you said, you know, he was the only son of this powerful couple in this provincial town. And he had a very bright political future. And he was going to be the mayor, you know, the next mayor after, you know, the current mayor retired. And Kai had a very interesting upbringing. She came from a rather, you know, ordinary family. And her mother had ambition ambition was just to move from a brick house to an apartment building, which was a very modern thing. And so, but Kai was beautiful, and Kai was an actress. So she had been trained as an actress since she was seven. And she acted on stage, all these heroines and the martyrs in, you know, revolutionary operas. And by the time she retired from the opera troupe, she needed a job. And then she got this beautiful job, I mean, wonderful gig, you know, as a news announcer. So she could use her beautiful voice. And she was also pretty. So she married Han because she was pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was desirable.
And Han's family is not necessarily doesn't think she was the best choice, but she's okay.
She was okay. You know, she had the first baby was a boy. You know, she was presentable.
Oh, Ming Ming.
Yeah, Ming Ming. Yeah, yeah.
Something happens. I don't want to go into the details of it because I don't want to. You know, we don't have time. Number one, but I also don't want to ruin the book for people. But at some point. And the thing that ties her together with Gu Shan, who's being executed, and Teacher Gu, is that Teacher Gu had them both in school when they were little girls. And in fact, they may have been friends or at least just classmates.
Right. They were classmates, yes.
And Kai does something which is not a wise thing to do for a person in her situation, which is she starts thinking about how she got where she got and how Gu Shan got where she got and wonders what the difference between them is.
Right. And in a way, she was, you know, both in the novel, you know, and in real life, they kind of echoed each other. You know, but they had different life experiences. And Kai, of course, she was, again, she thought a lot. You know, she did not think when she got married, but she started to think. And once someone starts thinking, you know, then, you know, she has a lot of questions. And she started to question everything about her life.
And that's what happened to Gu Shan, in fact,
that's true.
Going from a vicious Red Guard to a counter-revolutionary. Counter-revolutionary is a very bad word.
Apparently, yes.
There are a lot of casual cruelties in this book. It's just cruelty seems to be an undercurrent running through this book, whether it's the cruelty of the government or the cruelty of the people to each other. And I'm sitting here thinking, I don't know much about Chinese rural culture, certainly, and maybe a little more about Chinese culture in the big cities, maybe a little bit more about the emperors, you know, that kind of a thing. Is China a cruel culture? I mean, I'm looking at this from a Western point of view, and I don't want to, don't want to have that bias. But and was it made worse by the Cultural Revolution?
You know, I would not say it has a cruel culture, though it does have the history of, you know, things are looked upon a little bit differently, apparently, from Western standard. I can give you an example. You know, when I grew up, I was a very young girl, and my grandfather lived with us, and he would teach, you know, history to me as like a 3 or 4 year old girl, and he would say, in this famine in 1582, in this city, people exchanged their children so they could eat other people's children, so they would not go starving. And that's, I'm sure that happened in history, but that was the kind of thing that people thought was normal to teach a 4-year-old girl. So it was not cruelty. It was just a different standard, I would say. But I did agree. I think Cultural Revolution really did, I believe it really did bring out, you know, the cruel nature of human beings. When you are not treated nicely, you turn around and you treat the next person really horribly, and animals, and especially animals. I think that's a sign when how people treat animals also is a sign of how people would treat other human beings.
The crap always flows down, doesn't it?
Yeah, I know.
And winds up on the people least able to bear it.
Yeah.
Although in the book, there are any number of Chinese aphorisms, sayings, wisdoms both from the communist country and from the old Confucian society.
Right.
And one of them is that you never get anything that you can't handle, that whatever you're given is something you can probably bear. And I think they tell that to the Gu's, Teacher Gu and Mrs. Gu, that although the daughter's life and death has been a tragedy, this is something that they can bear up and just go on because they're in the great communist People's Republic of China, where the Communist Party is never wrong.
It's very interesting in that way. It's both very atheistic and also very fatalistic. You know, if you can have a good life, oh, wait for the next one. But where's the next one? I don't know. People would just always, you know, think better, you know, of their lives.
This book was fascinating in many, many ways. I enjoyed that you're a good writer.
Thank you.
But also the glimpse into a country twisted out of shape, a people, a culture twisted out of shape by a failed revolution. And I think in many ways it was a failed revolution. It didn't do what it was supposed to do. It didn't raise up the peasants. It didn't. It didn't make everybody equal under the red flag. What it did was it created new hierarchies and new ways for people to be abused. I learned a lot about China.
Thank thank you.
I suppose I don't know if there's a question in there somewhere. Is what were you attempting to do with this book? Was it simply to tell this relatively simple story, or do you feel like you want people to understand China and you?
I did not start thinking about I was going to write a book about China so people could understand the time or China. I guess I had much less ambition than that. In a way, I think I was just curious about why people behaved certain ways. And this novel, the story was this, outbreak and was this execution. It was a perfect canvas for me as a novelist just to look at the town, look at every character and see why he or she did things the way he did or she did. So it was more just out of fascination about human beings. And I think the fact that it was set in China in 1979 was kind of like a byproduct, because I had to make up this world to explain my fascination with these people.
So what's next for you? What are you working on now?
I think I'm about to wrap up another collection of stories and set in modern China, contemporary China, in 2008, and both, people in the cities and in the rural area. And next, after this book, after the collection, I think I'm going to do a novel.
Excellent. Well, please come back with your books. We'd love to talk to you again.
Oh, I would love to come back anytime. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Again, let me remind you that the title of the book is The Vagrants. The author is Yun Li, Y-I-Y-U-N-L-I, published by Random House. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Ed.